Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Nine people, your television set, and copyright law is where we begin today. The Supreme Court of the United States opines on the future of television. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 25th of June. So you go home tonight, you flip on the TV, and how much do you really care where the signal is coming from? Probably not all that much, am I right? You just want the content. But the people who own that content care very much, oh so much, about how it gets to you, which gets us to the Supreme Court's ruling in a case today called ABC versus Aereo. ABC, the broadcast network. Aereo, a whiz-bang new company that thought it had the future of television pretty much all sewed up. Until the Supreme Court said today, yeah, no, you don't. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. He has been on this story all the live long day. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
All right, layman's terms, first of all, what is Aereo? How does it work?
Okay, so Aereo is this startup. It basically rents you a tiny little dime-sized antenna that it stores in a warehouse in Brooklyn. And, you know, so far this has been not something involving, you know, our buddies in Brooklyn. But basically, it's this company that rents you an antenna and then allows you to stream content that's being sent out via broadcasters to your phone, your tablet, your computer, just like you would pick up on the old bunny ears television content.
Yeah, so they're taking over-the-air signal and retransmitting it, if you will, right? Through these little antennas. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
And the Supreme Court today said not so fast.
Not so fast. They scrambled their signal. The majority opinion, which was 6-3, basically says here's what you should be thinking about. Whether or not Aereo's business constitutes a public performance. Mm-hmm. And that means by housing all of these antennas together, are they rebroadcasting television content without paying for the licenses they need? And the Supreme Court said, yes. It's a different thing than if you and I were sitting in our private homes picking this stuff up on our bunny ears.
The CEO of Aereo has come out and said, we're not dead yet. We're going to try again. We're going to keep going. Barry Diller, the head of IAC, who gave Aereo a whole lot of money, said, yeah, no, we're dead.
Yes.
So where do we go?
Well, it's interesting. In the court opinion, there were some suggestions of a possible future for Aereo. Huh. And basically, if Aereo were a part of a larger company, maybe a cloud storage company, for instance, there might not be an issue here of whether or not it's acting too much like a cable company by rebroadcasting all this content. So there are some glimpses of a possible future for a company like Aereo. That said, you know, I think Barry Diller is probably on the right side, and Chet Kanoja, Aereo CEO, is, you know, he said in a statement, we will continue to fight for our consumers and fight to create innovative technologies that have a meaningful and positive impact on our world, end quote. But, you know, that sounds pretty vague to me. I don't know about you.
You are an Aereo user, we should say, right? What are you going to do?
Oh, man. I'm trying to figure out if I need to watch all the rest of my World Cup games in a loud bar or if I can do it in the comfort of my home. I think, you know, because this is in some ways this decision is now being kicked down to lower courts in terms of how it all gets sussed out. I think we've all got a little bit of time, us Aereo users.
Yeah.
I'm an early adopter, but, you know, I think suffice it to say I'm going to have to wait and see what else comes along that I can try and use.
Did you cut the cord to get on Aereo? Did you get rid of your cable subscription to get on Aereo?
I got on Aereo long after cutting the cord. Uh-huh. And I think one of the interesting things about this is that Aereo provided this technology that a lot of cord cutters love and want. And one of the interesting things to think about is you got to bet that these bigger companies are working on similar technologies, ways of letting you do this.
That's the point. That's what consumers want, right? They want this ability to get all this stuff wherever they want it.
Absolutely. And I think in 2014, I think that's actually a pretty reasonable ask. The question is, who's going to give it to you and how much are you going to pay and whether they got the licenses they need to do it?
Ben Johnson, he hosts Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Guy.
Winners on Wall Street today, companies that own the big broadcast networks. That's who the Supreme Court pretty much saved their bacon with that ruling this morning. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The A-list economic indicator out this morning, gross domestic product and a contraction of 2.9% in the first quarter was, at first blush, one of those, oh man, the wheels are coming off again numbers. I mean, right? Capitalism being what it is, though, here with the caveats. Number one, winter. Number two, lagging indicator. Number three, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Remember this?
11 degrees below zero right now in Chicago.
And that severe winter and people not going shopping or making stuff accounts for most of the contraction in gross domestic product in the first quarter. In fact, GDP fell much more than initially estimated.
Yeah, no, this is a terrible number.
But John Canale at brokerage firm LPL Financial says the markets have already blown it off because ever since winter, the economy's been heating up.
The second quarter looks pretty strong. So GDP, it's tracking to between 4 and 5%. It would be the best run rate on the economy since well before the Great Recession.
Consumer confidence is up, so is hiring by businesses. There are also problems, rising consumer prices, especially for food and gasoline. Workers' wages, meanwhile, are stagnant. MIT economist Jim Peterba heads up the National Bureau of Economic Research, which determines when the U.S. is officially in recession. He doesn't think there's much danger of that now. But he says the polar vortex reversal does teach us something.
There are closer links between extreme weather fluctuations and economic activity than we may recognize. At least potentially, extreme heat can have similar kinds of effects. You know, extreme demands on the electricity grid, for example.
The government's main weather forecasting bureau predicts it will be hotter than normal in many parts of the country this summer. Tropical vortex economy, anyone? I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
For those of you alive during the Nixon administration, this next story is brought to you by the OPEC embargo of 1973, when oil prices nearly quadrupled in just 6 months. One of the things that happened as a result was a ban on U.S. crude exports. 40 years later, that ban is still officially in effect. But the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that the Department of Commerce is going to let two private companies export a special type of domestically produced oil. It is a tiny opening into what could be a big change in the U.S. oil industry. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
The crude oil at issue is a specific type of lightweight crude called condensate. It's very different from what you probably picture when you think of crude oil. Condensate is not the thick black oil that came a bubbling up out of the ground in the opening credits of the Beverly Hillbillies. Condensate is thinner and can look like tap water, and it's highly volatile.
Condensate is actually one of the first crudes that would be the easiest to refine.
It would be the easiest to refine if it weren't for one problem, says oil analyst David Bellman.
The problem is that the refining industry for the last couple decades has been told that crude oil slate is going to get heavier and heavier.
So those refineries invested in equipment designed for refining heavy crude. But since the fracking boom, 96% of new oil production is ultralight, not heavy crude.
So it's not a great fit with the refineries in the U.S.
Severin Borenstein is co-director of the Energy Institute at the Haas School of Business at Berkeley. He says oil producers are worried that this bottleneck could get worse, driving down the price of condensate.
So the argument they're making is that they should be allowed to export those crude products.
Industry analyst Fadil Gate says lifting the ban would lower crude prices on the global market, but it would raise condensate prices in the U.S., and that's bad news for U.S. refineries, as evidenced by a dip in their stock prices today.
They had one of their worst days in years. Some of them are down by 10%.
There is no consensus among analysts on what lifting the ban would do to the price consumers pay for gas at the pump. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
I'm sure it's kind of been this way forever, but this does seem to be an era of rampant self-promotion, of personal brand building, and who has the most Twitter followers and who gets the most responses on a Google search. But there is a way to get ahead by doing just the opposite, keeping your nose to the grindstone, doing your job, and just waiting for people to notice. Sally Herships has that story.
If you are a celebrity, an athlete, a Greek god, odds are you've had a product named after you, like cologne. What is that? Does that say Zeus?
That says Zeus, yeah. That's all about me, actually.
Me is David Apel. He's a senior perfumer with Symrise, a fragrance company in New York. We're at his desk, which is covered with tiny glass vials of sample perfumes.
Now, Zeus is very ultra-masculine, very, rich, rugged, the sort of king of the hill of fragrance. So
I see something on here that says Love Mist.
Love Mist, yes. Not my name.
And none of these fragrances will be named after Apel. He says he doesn't need public recognition. Perfume is invisible, and he feels good when he smells one of his fragrances on someone. Besides, he says, when he began his career, he got a lot of satisfaction from being the go-to guy at his company, someone his colleagues could rely on.
So I still like that kind of behind-the-scenes role, being invisible.
Invisibles is the name of a new book by author Dave Zweig. It's about workers like Apel.
Well, invisibles are people who are highly skilled professionals whose work is critical to whatever endeavor they're a part of, but who go largely unnoticed by the public.
The anesthesiologist instead of the surgeon, the industrial engineer instead of the architect. Zweig says he got the idea when he was working as a fact checker at Condé Nast. He says the better he did his job, the more he disappeared.
When's the last time you've read a great magazine article and thought to yourself, man, that was fact checked beautifully? Never.
Today, says Zweig, we tend to equate power with attention, but often the people with real power are in the background. Invisible workers are often the most successful, but they view themselves as part of a team. Zweig says, although today's culture is focused on self-promotion, instead, we should focus more on our work and less on tweeting about it.
You know, one of the people I interviewed in the book had this really great line where he said, having a lot of followers doesn't get you good work. Doing good work gets you a lot of followers.
Zweig says this isn't about being meek and hiding in a corner. After all, there are times when promotion is necessary, like talking about your new book on the radio. It's just that we should focus on our work more, like invisibles. Zweig says they're meticulous, they savor responsibility, and they're ambivalent about recognition. Robert Bontempo teaches leadership at Columbia Business School. He says the name invisibles might be new, but the group isn't.
There's a very clear science that shows these are just stable individual differences. These are just different types of people.
Different types of people, says Bontempo, self-select into different types of careers.
Extroverted, life of the party types become marketers. They don't go into the lab. Detail-oriented people with strict attention to detail become accountants. They don't like self-promoting sales positions. It's just sort of human nature.
Both Zweig and Bontempo agree. You do have to promote yourself. It's just not clear how much. History, says Pontempo, is full of brilliant, hardworking people who did great work and are lost to history. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, big-name musicians you know, the people who put them on the charts, though.
There was a special kind of person who was not only a businessman, but a businessman with ears. People who could really spot talent, early talent.
But first, let's do the numbers. Those revised GDP numbers were so last quarter, you guys. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.25% today, 49 points, 16,867 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ added 0.33%, 29 points, finished at 43.79. The S&P 500 took home 0.5%, 9 points, closed at 1959. Broadcasters staged their own rally, as I was mentioning, after the Supreme Court removed the threat from Aereo. CBS jumped 6%, 20th Century Fox advanced 2%, Disney, parent of ABC and ESPN, stepped up 1.5%. Comcast, which owns NBC Universal, buzzed up 1% today. Morgan Stanley added 0.6%. JPMorgan Chase ended 0.2% ahead. Goldman Sachs gained 0.1% itself. Google kicked off its developers conference this morning. And news of smartwatches, set-top boxes, and car navigation systems, oh my, kicked up its shares 0.2%. Microsoft clicked up 0.3%. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. The NBA draft takes place in Brooklyn, New York, with the first pick going to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Two things that keep you moving: Winnebago and Nike are scheduled to release quarterly earnings. Next, let's go back in time and stand in a supermarket checkout line in Troy, Ohio. Come on, it'll be fun. Hear that beeping sound? 40 years ago, on June 26, a pack of Wrigley's gum made history when it became the first purchase scanned using a barcode. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're spending the next year or so on a special project that's called Learning Curve, about the way technology is changing education. And as you might think, there's lots of online video to watch, plenty of gee whiz tech gear and smartphone apps that are meant to appeal to kids that we have been plowing through. And also in the process, we have noticed how much noise all of it makes. So Marketplace's Adrian Hill went in search of the real meaning in the sounds of education technology.
That happy-sounding robot is Bo. He's bright blue and spins around. He's got a xylophone. And a big mission: to teach your 5-year-old how to code using an iPad and really simple programming language.
Robots are designed for fun and play and for learning.
Vikas Gupta is the co-founder of PlayEye, which makes the robot.
One of the things we do is we want to give the robot a lot of personality that will engage you, that will make you smile.
And that personality requires sounds. For those, PlayEye turned to the folks who created animated movies for Pixar. Think WALL-E and Cars. They created Bo's whees and otas.
And that's the hook that the robot comes in with. Like, it's something that you can imagine it to be anything you want to be. It doesn't have a life form or a shape that you're very familiar with. And then the personality comes out and engages you.
But before that preschooler can become a mini tech whiz, before she can program Bo to go left, turn, play the Star Wars theme song, parents have to fork over $169, which is where another type of sound comes in: the sound of the educational technology sell. The sound that'll convince you that this toy is the edge your kid needs.
I feel like such just a manipulator, you know, just kind of like a magician almost. I've got all these tricks.
Steven Wilson is a director and composer who helped create PlayEye's promotional video. Trick number one, simplicity.
That's like the main theme through the whole thing. It's so simple, you know, that's just basically two notes just going back and forth between it. And that to me, I feel like is very technological.
Trick two, an amped up melody.
It feels like a train is coming, you know what I mean? It's like, grab your bags, we're getting ready to go.
And this train is zooming to the technological future. You want to make sure your kid is on it. Then comes trick three.
This is actually the first time we go to minor in the whole song, right here.
Near the end of the video, we see a child playing with a robot. And then that child's future self, grown up, working, successful.
That chord right there. It was like the first time you maybe like felt a little emotional tug, I think. And that's because we did this. We went.
Did you feel that right there? That is the gotcha moment. When I, mom of a 1.5-year-old, felt all the hope I have for his future well up, and I wanted that toy. There's big money riding on making parents feel excited, feel hopeful about tech toys. The U.S. toy market is a $22 billion a year industry. The market for kids' electronics and educational toys is growing fast, which can explain why so much importance is being placed on the sound of things. Sounds create emotional connections.
If you look at consumer goods, emotional connection is part of the buying decision.
Bruce Walker researches sound and technology in the psychology school at Georgia Tech.
We're going to hear more sounds from our technology.
More sounds from our phones and our computers and our kids' electronics. Not, he says, devices trying to sound like people.
I believe that those sounds are going to be much more naturalistic, much more gentle.
Sounds that make us feel connected to our electronics. So we're okay with the fact we're letting them teach our kids. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
You felt that little tug, right? Take a minute and see how music affects your emotions. There is an audio quiz at marketplace.org/learningcurve. To rip off Mark Twain, if I might, reports of the death of the music industry have been greatly exaggerated. Nobody's going to stop making music, of course, but the business model has been challenged in this digital age. The record industry has been down before, and it will be down again, but it is going to bounce back every single time. That is the gist of Gareth Murphy's new book. It's called Cowboys and Indies, The Epic History of the Record Industry. Gareth, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to go to the introduction of this thing, actually, and ask you about a phrase you use. You trot it out right away. You talk about real record man. He was a real record man, that guy. Why is that idea, the idea of the producer, the person who can spot a record, so important in the history of the recording industry?
I think because these people are so rare. I mean, it made me realize that there were important distinctions within the record industry, that there were businessmen and there were execs, but there was a special kind of person who was not only a businessman, but a businessman with ears, people who could really spot talent, early talent. And they're all the ones that have, you know, made the record industry what it is.
Give me a couple of for instances. Who are some of these guys? And probably women, too. Are there any women, actually?
There are actually some, yeah. and that was one reason why we didn't call the book Record Man, because we thought it was maybe a little bit sexist, but John Hammond, I think, would probably be the greatest one of all. He found Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Leonard Cohen. I mean, so the thing that all of these people have in common is that they're able to spot talent in different eras, and that's the real difference between the real record man and the guy who gets lucky.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. You make much in this book of the, not a distinction, but I guess a dichotomy between the majors, the major record labels, and the indies. There can be a peaceful coexistence, right? It doesn't have to be either or.
Sure, absolutely. And one thing's for sure is that the indies, by nature, I mean, they're looking to break even. They're companies, the business...
Which is a tricky business model, right? Hey, we're going to break even today.
Exactly. Yeah. They're passionate people. Right. They're doing it because they love music. They're not really doing it to make money. But there always comes a time when any artist knows that he will need a lot of money invested in him. They need mass exposure. And the only people who can afford that are the majors. So they do need to coexist. Mm. And this conflict, I think that it's the kind of competition that has helped make the music industry survive.
You know, there's that old saying of those who do not remember their history are condemned to repeat it. And you have written what you say right in the introduction. You want it to be the encyclopedic history of the recording industry. Why do you think it's important that the recording industry specifically know from whence it came?
Yeah, I mean, that became, I guess, the motivation to write the book. And the big question I asked myself was, do the guys today actually know this happened before? And so I went around trying to ring everyone just to know, to see if my theory held true. Yeah. And sure enough, absolutely nobody did.
And this is the crash of the record industry back in the Victorian era versus the CDs recently, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This was, I suppose, the phonograph crash of the 1920s was just a mirror image of the CD crash in the late 90s, early 2000s. Just like economic crashes happen on Wall Street, the same thing happens in the record industry. When bubbles get too big and people forget to not invest in the future, when things are unsustainable as the CD was. And there will be a renaissance, but we have to get back to the music.
It's all about the music, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. That's the deal.
It is. Yeah. It always was the thing. I mean, I always say that the music business, it's two things. It's music and it's business, but it's music first and business afterwards. And I think the music industry really did forget that.
Gareth Murphy's history of the recording industry is called Cowboys and Indies. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, getting us back to where we started, your television set and how what's on it gets to you. Ben Johnson mentioned he was a cord cutter when we talked earlier. That is, he does TV online without cable. Well, two reasons for that. One, he's just a hip kind of guy. But number two, a survey out from the market research firm NPD Group says the average cable bill now sits right near $90 a month and will, hang on to your hats, hit $200 a month by the end of the decade. $200 a month for television. Yeah, we're done. All right, that's Marketplace from APM on this Wednesday, my calendar says. Today, the Dow up 0.25%, 49 points. The NASDAQ added 0.33%, 29 points. The S&P 500 took home 0.5%. That is 9 points. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.